Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Our subject today is the philosophy of history.
And the philosophy of history asks, why did men act as they did in the past? What is the cause and meaning of the rises, the falls, the turning points, the key developments of previous cultures and centuries up to and including our own? What is the fundamental factor, the prime mover, shaping the course of human history? Many different answers have been given to this question through the ages. Karl Marx, for instance, one of the most famous people in the field, advanced the economic interpretation of history, according to which productive and economic factors are the real source of human development, the real cause of everything that happens, and philosophy and ideology is merely a superstructure. Much better. St. Augustine, who carved out this field originally, ascribed all events to the will of God. Thomas Carlyle advanced the great man theory, according to which a few outstanding individuals in various centuries are the actual causes of everything that happens. A typical skeptic would say, there is no factor causing history, it's all chance. A typical eclectic, which would be 90% of today's professors, say, it's a little bit of all of the above. The objectivist viewpoint, as I'm sure you know, is what we call the philosophic interpretation of history. That is to say, we hold that philosophy is the decisive causal factor. The philosophy of any given age is the decisive factor shaping the actions of men and the events of that age. Now, I see some faces that I don't recognize, so forgive me for one moment to just indicate what I mean by philosophy. It basically consists of three branches. Metaphysics, which studies the nature of the universe as a whole. Epistemology, which tells us the means of human knowledge, how do we know. And ethics, which tells us how to live, provides a code of values to guide human choices and actions. So philosophy is that subject that studies fundamentals, that tells us what is there, how do you know, and so what. Now, that philosophy is the basic cause of history was really the thesis of my book, The Ominous Parallels. Counter to appearances, my book was not about Germany and America. They were merely two examples. I deliberately picked two countries that were opposite in every way except one. They were opposite in their traditions, in their peoples, in their history, in their way of life, in their heroes, you name it. The only one common denominator was the philosophy of their dominant intellectuals. The philosophy that entered America in the post-Civil War period and that dominated Germany for many, many centuries. So it was like a controlled experiment where all the factors varied but one. And I argue that this one factor conditioned and swamped all the rest and is therefore leading us now to the same kind of result. Now, in the book, I concentrated on economic factors, and specifically on an anti-Marxist polemic, although I didn't often mention his name, but I was concerned there to argue repeatedly that the cause of history is not so-called economic or practical factors, that they are merely a resultant of ideas. Now, if you recall, I tried to show that the laissez-faire economics is a product of the philosophy of the Enlightenment, that totalitarian economics under the Nazis was a product of the unreason of the 20th century, and that the mixed economy which we have today comes from a union of some Enlightenment elements and some irrationalist elements. Now, I'm taking that discussion for granted today. I don't want to discuss economic interpretation further. I want today to focus on the psychological interpretation of history, the role of psychological explanations in history. And I want to begin by giving you the case for a psychological interpretation of history. As far as this theory is concerned, it doesn't make any difference what your theory of psychology is. You might be a Freudian, as many advocates of this theory are, or you might have any number of different approaches to psychology. But the idea of this is you explain people's behavior through the centuries, you explain the rises and falls and key developments of history, in terms of the psychology of the actors. What is the case in favor of this, which I think is the most plausible of the wrong theories of history? Well, the case goes like this. It's obvious that most people have no articulate, coherent philosophy. Philosophy to most people is just a smattering of bromides. So it's even questionable, it's claimed, whether they have a philosophy. But it's obvious that they do have psychologies. Everybody has motivations, psychological needs, subconscious defenses, or most people do, quests for security, the need to reduce anxiety, protect self-esteem, etc. You can rattle off whatever psychological filling you want here. It's also obvious that people, so it's said, that people act on the basis of their psychologies. That is, their motives, their desires, their defenses, or whatever, really explain what they do in a way that references to inflation or price controls, etc., do not explain what they do. So the question is, why not then advance an outright psychological interpretation of history and explain events by the dominant psychology of the people in a given era? Now that you can make a plausible case illustrating this theory, for instance, if we take Nazism, which was the subject of my book, it goes like this. You couldn't account for leaders like Hitler and Goering and Goebbels and so on if there weren't men with a tremendous power lust, a tremendous need for domination, sadism, etc. And you couldn't have the mass following that they had if there wasn't a nation of people with a psychology of dependence, people who felt the need to merge into the group, to fit in, to belong, to be taken care of. People who lacked self-esteem and who wanted to conform, and of course then the leader pandered to this by telling them you're noble to obey. Now obviously, and here I'm speaking factually, all these factors exist. And obviously they had to exist. And that much is true. Nazism would not be possible if there were no power lusters and no dependents in a country. Kant, it's claimed, and whichever philosophers you hold responsible, could preach till he was blue in the face. But if it was a nation without power lusters or masses of dependents, it would have no effect. Now this theory, in its better form, sometimes it's advanced in a very brazen, brash form, which says philosophy is just completely insignificant, but the more sophisticated advocates of this theory say, philosophy is not completely irrelevant. They say that philosophy does have a role, a kind of minor or part-time role in the cause of events, in that it serves as a rationalization for motives that people are ashamed to admit. It serves to make respectable or palatable what things people would otherwise be ashamed of. So, for instance, if a power luster were to admit to himself or to mankind openly, the way, for instance, O'Brien does in 1984, that all he wants is to stamp a boot in the face forever, or the way Ellsworth Toohey does to Peter Keating, that all he wants is power for its own sake, so it's argued people would cringe. They just wouldn't accept it. But if he says, my goal is service to the masses, and so on, and that's what really motivates me, this is an expression of altruism and humanitarian love, then people accept it. So philosophy serves as a cover-up. And the same on the side of dependence. People would hesitate, it's claimed to say, I am nothing, I want to be nothing, I want simply to fit into anything that'll take care of me. But if you tell them, you're engaged in a high virtue, your obedience is self-sacrifice for a noble cause, they say, terrific. So they act on the first motive, but under the cover of philosophy. The idea being, therefore, the real cause is the psychology that's moving these people, both on the giving and receiving end, the leader and the follower. Philosophy is simply a cover-up. So it's like an accessory cause of the development, but not the true source. Now you can, I think, easily see that this theory could be applied to any main event of history. for example, as applied to modern art. Now here, of course, what interpretation you offered would depend on whether you're for or against modern art, but from an objectivist point of view, we'll give them a negative psychology. But you could say, as to the basic founders of modern art, they were moved by a jealousy of achievement that they couldn't equal, by resentment, by a desire to destroy, by a nihilistic rage of the kind I indicated in the chapter on Weimar culture. And in addition, you could say they wanted something for nothing commercially, and they found an easy racket. As to the public, well, they depended upon people who were afraid to stand up and exercise their own judgment, people who would, in effect, be cowed by authorities. So all this philosophic talk about another dimension, and we're really expressing the voice of a higher truth and so on that these modern artists use, is again just a cover-up for, in this case, a venomous hatred. Now, you can see again, some such psychology, assuming the objectivist approach to modern art, some such psychology must have existed, or the phenomenon wouldn't have been possible. So to that extent, there is something here. One more example. I've heard this often applied to America, to the American Constitution. In fact, Charles Beard wrote a famous book which is allegedly the economic interpretation, but is really the psychological interpretation of the Constitution, in which he claimed that the basic desire moving the founding fathers was greed, the desire for money, wealth, to protect their property. In other words, that it was a private emotion that really motivated them, but that they felt guilty. And therefore, they made a lot of abstract talk about individual rights and the power of reason and so on, but that was just a cover-up. And again, it certainly is a fact that the founding fathers wanted property and wanted to keep their property. So to sum up the theory, human nature is a source of various guilty emotions. People really act on these, but use philosophy to disguise what they're doing. The real source, however, is these psychological factors. Now, with that brief case, let us look and see what is wrong with this theory. Well, the first thing I would ask is, I don't deny that there are psychological factors that are indispensable to historical development. But the first question is, what is the source of these psychological factors? Where do they come from? What is their cause? Now, you cannot say that any given psychology emanates from human nature as such, not any specific psychology, because not everyone has any of the motivations that we mentioned or any other. And these motivations are very, very differently manifested in different eras of history. In some eras, there are tremendous number, carloads of power lusters. And there are masses of fear-ridden dependents rushing after them, asking what to do. In other eras, unfortunately not our own, but for instance the Enlightenment, somehow the power lusters, although they existed then to some extent, somehow they were not such a factor, there were not so many of them. And the same for the psychology of dependence. The average man in that era did not seem to feel the need of a dictator telling him what to do. Why? In other words, what is the source of power lust, dependence, nihilism, greed, or whatever on a cultural scale? Now remember, we're not talking about a random marginal individual. A given individual might have any psychology in any era, because there is free choice, as we'll comment on later. But we're talking of a psychology on a scale wide enough to shape a culture and be a factor in history. What is the source of psychology on such a scale? Well, let me give you the abstract answer first. You can see that all of these psychologies come down to really one thing, however complex the terminology. They come down to certain emotions, certain desires, urges, whatever. certain feelings, whether the desire to have power or money or depend on others or destroy or whatever. And the source of feelings, if you know objectivism, is what? Ideas. The whole essential distinction between a feeling or emotion on the one hand and a sensation on the other is that a sensation can be transmitted by strictly physical means. If I stick a pin in you in the right place, it doesn't make any difference whether you're an objectivist or a communist, you feel a certain physical sensation. But an emotion like love or fear or whatever is obviously a product of your mental content, your ideas, your value judgments. It's not a primary, it's not irreducible, it's not innate, it comes from what you think, consciously or otherwise. It comes from ideas. And the only ideas which pertain to fundamental ideas, and which thereby pervade a whole society, which engulf every social class, and every economic class, every educational group, the fundamental ideas that sweep everybody, that's what we mean by philosophic ideas. Not specialized ideas that pertain only to a few individuals or a specific group, but that which pertains to the issues that everybody has to deal with one way or the other. That is why I say the argument really theoretically as psychology comes down in this theory to feelings, and feelings on a scale that shape a culture come down to philosophic ideas. And that is the basic argument for why philosophy must be the source of history. Now, this takes on more content if we give some examples. How would philosophy, for instance, breed a psychology of dependence? Because I think it does. If you have dependence on a culture-wide scale, I think you have to trace that back to philosophy. And actually, I believe it works in two ways, philosophy does, to produce a psychology. Indirectly, via shaping the institutions of a country, and then directly by the explicit statement of its intellectuals. Indirectly, for example, philosophy will shape a political system. And the political system, for instance, suppose it is statism, will result practically in the average man having less and less control over his life, more dependence on the government, more need to join a pressure group simply to get by. At the same time, the working out of these status systems will confront him with one crisis after the other, inflation, depression, war, whatever. He will feel he's out of control. He can't trust his judgment. He doesn't know how to make sense of it. He's helpless alone. He has to turn to a group and depend upon the collective for survival. This is quite apart from anything he's told explicitly. It's the working out of the system, which was itself shaped by abstract philosophy, ultimately. If you then add in the explicit pounding that the average man gets from the intellectuals, and I mean now not just the professors, the school teachers, the scientists, the artists, the constant chorus, your mind is helpless, who are you to know, thinking is untrustworthy, there are no answers, there are no absolutes, the individual is doomed, and so on. He has nowhere to turn. His life seems to convince him that you have to be a dependent, and everything he hears tells him that's the only moral, and the two factors together are enough to collapse most people's attempt to fight it. Now, if you project these two factors together, operating across generations, you can see that you could begin with a relatively independent country and create a need of dependence, a need for authority figures to tell you what to do. And the method is simply, use philosophy to make independence impossible, existentially and intellectually. And after a while, you will hear a massive cry, "Take care of me. I'm lost, I'm helpless, I don't know what to do." And of course, it would theoretically work the same way on a positive direction. If you use philosophy to establish a free country, people would thereby have more individual control over their lives. The system would demand and reward independence. It wouldn't be dotted with inexplicable crises. Plus, there would be some intellectuals, hopefully, eternally vigilant, and urging people to use their minds, stand on their own. They would read Horatio Alger and not Franz Kafka. And the result would be you would breed independence in a whole generation. Now, I think this is exactly the pattern of what happened to the United States. Unfortunately, not the latter, the former case. That is, as the corrupt philosophy started to come in, it gradually shaped the institutions, reshaped them across time by degrees, reshaped the colleges much more rapidly, and the result is the psychology that we see in this country today, in which the original American sense of life, although there are elements of it still remaining, is certainly very, very much diminished and corroded from what it was. Now, this is by way of one example, philosophy generating a psychology of dependence. If you ask about the other side of power lust, you know that power lust is really only a corollary or aspect of dependence. Basically, the power luster has the idea you live by ruling or being ruled. He is just as dependent, just as unsure, the dictator is, as the masses of people. He merely chooses a variant mode of expressing it. And when you find masses of power lusters, the basic explanation is still a psychology of dependence. And of course, they get away with it because of the frightened masses of people who want someone to tell them what to do. Or take one more example, the founding fathers' desire for wealth. Now, did philosophy have a role in creating this? Or is it just as the Marxists hold part of human nature or the dialectic process? Obviously, philosophy had a tremendous role. The desire for wealth is not a primary. It is not inherent in human nature. It is not. A simple example of that, if you recall Starnesville in Atlas Shrugged, these were people who had no desire for material wealth. Or, if you don't want fiction, you look at primitives around the globe today, or look at the medieval saints. There was a whole culture whose saints and heroes gloried in eating sheep's gall, drinking laundry water, and sleeping on rocks. These are not people who would have made shareholders in General Motors. A whole constellation of values, ideas, intellectual development, secularism was required to produce a culture in which people wanted material wealth. If you know any history, you know that the modern Western world was a product of the Aristotelian philosophy, reintroduced by Thomas Aquinas. The idea is that this world is good, success is desirable, happiness on earth is the proper goal, it's good to enjoy yourself, your body is good, your mind is trustworthy, this world is real, you can be efficacious. And then on the basis of these ideas, the gradual development of the institutions that rewarded individual enterprise and initiative. And across centuries, what finally evolved was a culture that was pro-wealth. Of course, then if you jump in on the development at this point and say the founding fathers wanted property, obviously they did. But that was not because it's inherent in human nature. It took centuries of intellectual preparation. On the other hand, in the 12th century, when they held this world is unreal, success is bad, the body is evil, suffering is the goal, the mind is worthless, you should get out of here, not enjoy it. And you had the institutions which expressed this philosophy, the guild feudal system, in which the individual had no chance for independent action, then of course there was no comparable desire for wealth. There were some people, undoubtedly, insofar as man is alive, he can't escape, or some people can't escape, to some extent, the need of wealth, or some kind of material goods. But it would be absolutely nothing like in the United States in the 18th century or in the modern world. They would consider what we regard as civilization now as scandalous, sinful, terrifying, horrifying. So even the exceptions would think more wealth was, in effect, more meat and cleaner rags. First, you had to have wealth created in abundance, and that was thanks to philosophy. Now, let us look for a moment to another point to clarify the role of philosophy in generating psychology. There are exceptions to the dominant trend in any age. For instance, I mentioned there can certainly be power lusters in the Enlightenment. There were independent men in Weimar Germany before Hitler. There were, as I've just said, wealth seekers to some extent in the Middle Ages. In other words, people that did not reflect the dominant philosophy of their culture. But my point is this. Such exceptions, people who go counter to the dominant philosophy of their era, lead nowhere historically unless they enter the realm of philosophy. Such exceptions lead nowhere historically unless they enter the realm of philosophy. Otherwise, they simply have to beat their head against a stone wall. A power luster in the Enlightenment was simply doomed to frustration. People would not follow him. An independent man in Germany had to flee for his life. A wealth seeker in the Middle Ages became a bandit or was burned at the stake. These exceptions did not change the course of history. And the principle is this. A psychology can become motivating historically only when it reflects the dominant philosophy. A psychology can become motivating historically only when it reflects the dominant philosophy. Otherwise, it's merely an oddity without further effect. Now, you may ask, where do such anomalies or exceptions come from? How are they possible? And the answer is really quite simple. People have free will. They can exercise it. They don't have to conform to the dominant trend. A man can be better or worse than his contemporaries. He can reach ideas on his own, implicitly if not explicitly, ideas which differ from those around him. And he can thereby shape his own character and end up better or worse than his age. Now, this happens to be a very rare exception. But even here, in this type of exception, ideas, in this case the man's own ideas, are still the factor at work shaping his psychology. What is true, though, is that it's not the period's dominant ideas anymore. It's the local personal ideas of the given exception. So if you say to me, is every psychology a product of philosophy? I say, well, that depends what you mean by philosophy. If you mean by philosophy fundamental ideas, explicit or implicit, held in some form, then I would say yes, a philosophy underlies every psychology. But if you mean by philosophy the specific system of ideas spread throughout a given culture at a given time, then no. Most individuals will be shaped by this, but not necessarily all. Now let's for a moment pursue the question, suppose a person with an exceptional psychology did want to influence history. He was different from his fellows and he wanted to have them come his way. How would he do it? If you concretize this, you will see he could only do it by changing people's philosophy. Take this power luster we hypothesized in the Enlightenment. How would he get people to start accepting his commands or somebody's commands? In essence, he would have to make obedience a virtue in their mind and independence and self-assertion a vice. He'd have to inculcate in them the idea, it's wrong to think for yourself. You should accept what other people tell you. Who are you to know? The mind is helpless. He'd have to do, in effect, exactly what Immanuel Kant did. Probably he wouldn't live long enough to cash in. It would be his great-grandkids who would become the dictator. But he could only do it by entering the stream of philosophy. The same way for a wealth seeker in the Middle Ages, he would have to basically do what Thomas Aquinas did and change the philosophy. So you come back to the point that only philosophy moves history. Now I want to look at the idea that philosophy is really only a rationalization, not a cause. And that was part of the original theory, as you remember. Now, there are some obvious cases where philosophy serves this role. But I do not believe that, in essence, this is the role of philosophy. I would never say the essential role of philosophy is to serve as a rationalization or a cover. It's much deeper than that. Philosophy creates the basic psychology of an age and then urges people to act on it. It sanctions or endorses the psychology that it created, and it disarms any opposition. It makes opposition timorous, hesitant, frightened, and ultimately helpless. It makes the psychology that it has created into a virtue, and opposition to it an evil or a vice. I don't believe that philosophy is primarily rationalization. What philosophy does is actually endorse the allegedly guilty hidden motives that it creates. Those motives are not hidden. Counter to what some superficial observers may think, the motives that move an age are not hidden. They scream out at you. And what philosophy does is endorse those motives. In that sense, people do not disguise their actions. Not in essence. They have integrity, speaking on a historical scale. They preach and act together. I do not believe that hypocrisy is a factor in history. Not if you're speaking on a world scale. Now, for instance, the theory is Hitler really wanted power, but preached universal sacrifice as a cover-up to disguise it. Well, think about this alleged cover-up. How much brains does it take to realize that universal sacrifice requires somebody collecting the sacrifice and telling the sacrificers what to do and when to sacrifice? This alleged cover-up is only a form of the real motive of power lust on his part. There is no dichotomy here between the real motive and the official philosophy. The official philosophy is just a form of the real motive, and the reason it works is because universal sacrifice is other language for submit to power. I would be impressed by this rationalization theory if Hitler really wanted power, but covered it up by preaching the sanctity of individual rights, because then he really covered it up. But of course, that rationalization would stop him dead in his tracks. The only reason the rationalization works is precisely because it unleashes the motive that actually is operative. So there is no hypocrisy here. Whatever you say about Hitler, he committed every sin in the book, but not that one. That works throughout. The masses supposedly wanted obedience, but covered it up by saying they were being selfless. And here again, what is selflessness? It means not thinking or judging on your own, so it means obedience. It's a form of obedience, and that's why it worked as a so-called rationalization. But if they had preached self-assertion, that wouldn't have worked. The same is true for all the other examples that anyone could give. The modern artists systematically preach that we should take away every element of every artwork until only nothing remains. Now, that is not a disguise of nihilism. I did not have to infer nihilism. I just had to look at what they're doing. They didn't cover that up. They do that openly. And the same for the founding fathers. They preach the right to happiness, which is an inherently selfish doctrine, and the sanctity of property rights. So if that's greed, they avowed their greed. Now, this will apply however you, whatever aspect you look at. The historical motives on a historical scale are open, stated, avowed. They are not covered up. And in fact, if you think about it, you'll see that it's hard even to draw a line, speaking now historically, between philosophy and psychology. If you see philosophy in essential terms and psychology in essential terms, across an entire culture, it's the same one thing. It's not two things. You can with regard to an individual man, in some cases distinguishes philosophy and his psychology. Because there you mean his official ideas, formally, explicitly avowed as his philosophy, and the ideas that he's tied into his subconscious and his emotional mechanism. If there's a conflict between the two, which happens in sometimes individual cases, you can call then his subconscious his psychology. But if there is no conflict within a man between his conscious and his subconscious, there is no distinction between his philosophy and his psychology. If you meet an ordinary man and he shakes hands with you, says, "How do you do? I'm glad to meet you." He's friendly. Is that his philosophy? Certainly. He has a certain view of people. He's acting accordingly. Is it his psychology? Yeah, he feels friendly. You can't distinguish between those two. When could you? If he avows, he goes to lectures, and he's how benevolent life is and so on, and when he meets someone, he has an uncontrollable urge to smash him in the face. He has a conflict, we say, between philosophy and his psychology. But that type of thing is a local, isolated instance, and it really applies only to a small handful of individuals, relatively, who have accepted a philosophy in adulthood at variance to the psychology, to the philosophy they grew up with, and who are having difficulty digesting it. That is a very peripheral issue, historically speaking. It does not apply to a society as a whole. You can't have a whole society on an analyst's couch. And in that sense, in terms of a society as a whole, the psychology is merely the emotional implementation of the philosophy, just as the economics is the existential implementation. Therefore, I deny that philosophy is only a rationalizer. It is much more direct and important. It creates the motives that move history, endorses those motives, and frightens off opponents. On this last point, you see that sometimes human nature requires the opposite element of a given psychology to some extent. Certain psychologies can't be 100% complete or everyone would die at that moment. So they have to bootleg some better elements. But what the philosophy does in such a case is disarm and intimidate the people with the better elements. It makes only the psychology that it creates acceptable and proper and frightens off any opposition. Thus, there could be very strong anti-Nazis in Germany, but they were hesitant to open their mouth because Hitler had the aura of morality. Or if you take a completely reverse example, there were very strong Tories in the American Revolution who were very opposed to independence, but the whole culture put them on the defensive. They couldn't talk about the glories of union with the motherland in an age where individualism was the watchword. So they were disarmed and futile, and you see that type on television all the time. Now, if you're ready, I want to carry this discussion one step further to the climax. This is the climax of the answer to the psychological interpretation. You may very well ask at this point, well, what about thinkers, philosophers themselves? Where do their ideas come from? Couldn't a person argue the ideas of an original philosopher obviously don't come from his predecessors? He's an originator. So they have to come somehow from his own inner self, his own inner nature and resources. In other words, his own what? Psychology. And for example, this is the last gasp of the psychological theory. For example, Kant had a hatred for the good, let us say, and a pietistic upbringing and a whole bunch of things like that. And that led to his philosophy as a rationalization or expression of his psychology. And so they say psychology in the end is still the cause of history. Even if philosophy causes psychology in the masses, in the originators, their psychology is the cause of their philosophy. So the root is still finally psychology. You know the answer to that? Well, here is my answer to that. My answer is, first I'll just state it flatly. You cannot explain an original philosophy as a product of a psychology. In fact, I will go further. You cannot explain an original philosophy at all other than by reference to the volition of a genius. You can explain the preconditions which made it possible to be formulated and the conditions which make it possible to influence other people. But the actual origination of an original system of philosophy, I hold, cannot be explained. Now let's pursue this. Let's take the hypothetical development of Kant schematically. Now, I don't mean to libel him, we're just taking him as an example of the most evil philosopher in history. Now, let's say he does not get his ideas from observation of reality, obviously. And let's say he doesn't make it even doesn't get them from honest errors. Therefore, in some sense, let's say he had to have a warped psychology, a lust for destruction, power, whatever. The point is, this does not mean that his psychology leads to or causes his philosophy. It does not mean that. All kinds of people, or at least many, many more than one man in Königsberg, had that same kind of hatred and power, lust and resentment, etc., and did not, therefore, become great philosophers who changed the course of history. That psychology does not per se lead to the creation of a philosophy. What does? Well, I would say, on the level we're here talking about, there are two factors that you have to mention as to what is the root of the creation of an original philosophy. Number one is genius, by which I mean a tremendous abstract range, the kind of intellectual ability and intelligence that can spend a life at home in the very, very widest abstractions, and that can, in some significant sense, understand them, you know, and not just complete babble. And the second is, even assuming that endowment, the commitment to a full life of abstract thought. Now, philosophy, as you understand, if you're talking about the origination of a philosophic system, is not a part-time endeavor. It takes decades for a mind to mature to the point where it can begin that, and then decades to apply it even to the few key issues necessary to leave to posterity the substance of a system. This is a full lifetime commitment that an individual has to choose to make. He has to decide, supposing he's Kant, and even if he doesn't do this consciously, but it has to amount to this, that he has to take his inner rage and translate it into a full complicated philosophic system with a theory of concepts and percepts and every other thing there is, relating it to his predecessors, tying it in to the current cultural context, injecting it into the ongoing current of human thought. Now, this is a virtually incredible act of choice, thought, abstraction across decades. It is not derivable from or predictable by reference to childhood or teenage adolescent psychology. The most you can say with regard to psychology is this. The originator of a corrupt system, and I mean now corrupt as opposed to simply mistaken, must have a bad psychological motivation somewhere. But that is merely a necessary, not a sufficient condition. Countless Germans undoubtedly had the same essential psychology as Kant that did not make them immortal philosophers. Now, this same applies to good philosophers or mistaken philosophers. But take good philosophers. Let's say that Aristotle was psychologically very healthy. That did not make him an epical turning point positive philosopher. Presumably, there have been many people who had varying degrees of health and maybe were wonderfully healthy, but they did not go into philosophy, or if they did, they did not discover a total system such as Aristotle's. You cannot derive his philosophy from a magnificent inner psychology or Kant's from a magnificent, corrupt inner psychology. The idea of psychology as the cause of philosophers is simply makes no sense. So then you will ask me, well, if you trace the events of history, psychology, economics, etc., back to philosophy in essence, then how do you explain philosophy? What causes a man to come up with a given system? Why did Kant or Aristotle or whoever arise when they did? And you might think this is the ultimate question left. But I do not regard that as a valid question, because you cannot have an infinite regress. You can't go back forever. Even if I were to give you an answer, suppose I were to say, philosophy derives from X. If a man has X, he becomes a philosopher, and if not, not. That's the true primary. That would not satisfy you for a minute. It might today, but the next lecture you'd say, well, where did X come from? You got to start somewhere. The basic cause has to be a primary. What I think you can do is state the preconditions of a new philosophy arising, being created, and the preconditions of its being accepted. But preconditions are not the same as causes. They do not necessitate. They make the philosophy possible, but that's all, no more. And I would state the following preconditions for the creation of a new philosophy. Now I'm talking here of an original philosophy, not the obvious working out of the master by disciples. You can easily explain the working out of the master's thought as a mere consequence of the master. So, for instance, Plotinus does not pose a big problem if you know about Plato. Theophrastus is not a mystery if you know Aristotle. John Dewey follows very simply from William James, etc. The disciples are clear enough, and if they didn't do it, all kinds of other people would leap up to do it. We're talking here about explaining the major originators, whether for good or evil, the turning point systems of history. And my opinion, by the way, there are only four to date. And I would name that, I'm sure you know, as Plato, Aristotle, Kant, and Ayn Rand. Now, I will list the following as the preconditions of these philosophies arising. The preconditions not being the same, of course, as the causes. Number one. The necessary context of knowledge must exist. You could not have had Plato in the 6th century BC before the distinctions that were reached by the pre-Socratics. You could not have had Kant without Plato and Christianity. You see, there's a hierarchy of knowledge, and there's even a hierarchy of error. You build certain knowledge on earlier knowledge and certain errors on earlier errors, and they would not have been possible de novo, from scratch. And by the same token, you could not have had Ayn Rand without Aristotle. And as she herself pointed out, you could not have had Ayn Rand before the Industrial Revolution. She often maintained that her ethics could not have been properly discovered in a period prior to industrialization, when people did not see the actual practical need of thought in the sustaining of human life. So one, the necessary context of knowledge must exist. Two, I would say, we can grant that the necessary psychological predispositions have to be formed by the individual. The necessary psychological predispositions have to be formed. But actually, they grow up simultaneously with the incipient philosophy, so it's really one unit. And this is true whether we're talking about disease, as in the case of Kant, or health, as in the case of Aristotle. So I grant a certain type of psychology goes along, but it typically exists without leading to a philosophy, and it can't be regarded as the cause. At most, you can say it's one of the factors predisposing an individual. And thirdly, I would say, the necessary cultural context must exist to make possible the widespread acceptance of the philosophy. The necessary cultural context must exist to make possible the widespread assimilation of the philosophy. For example, if we had an objectivist society and Kant came along, he would have a lot of trouble getting a foothold, whereas in the early 19th century, they were just ripe for the plucking. By the same token, if Ayn Rand had philosophized under Hitler, she would have had no chance, no time, and nothing in the culture to attach to, so she wouldn't have got anywhere. She always said that the one chance that she had was to get to America. So if you're talking about the spread of a philosophy, a person can't do that independent of a certain cultural context. Those are the three major factors I would name as preconditions. But the point is that none of these dictates the actual philosophy. The act of creation itself is volitional, and the faculty of abstract genius involved transcends them. Now, I'm using genius here in a non-value sense. I don't mean good, because I'm obviously including Kant. But I mean extraordinarily abstract. So you cannot, in my view, ask the question, why Kant or why Ayn Rand? Why now? Why in Germany? Why in Russia? Etc. I don't think you can say any more about any such major philosopher then. This is what certain supremely endowed individuals chose to do with their lives and minds, for good or evil. That's it. Now, you can see that there's a very obvious parallel here to the objectivist view of free will. You know that the objectivist view of free will is the choice to think or not. And beginning students often have the problem when they hear that the choice is to think or evade, but why did he think? Or why did he evade? And you know that we can give preconditions. We can say a man, for instance, would not evade in a situation where there was no conceivable motive to do so. He wouldn't think if there was no value or context relevant or motivating him. But the point is this, preconditions are not causes. He still has the basic decision, should I give in to this motive, should I act on this desire or not, should I think or not, and why he does one or the other cannot be more deeply explained. That is what it means to say this is a choice. A fundamental choice. A fundamental means that beneath which you cannot get. Now, really, what I'm saying is simply this same objectivist theory of free will applied now within the realm of the philosophy of history. Mankind's most abstract minds have to make that same choice, too. And I don't think it can be more deeply explained on their level either. If the deepest abstract mind of an age chooses to think, then you get Aristotle and, when the conditions are ripe, an Aristotelian age. If that mind chooses to evade as a lifetime abstract philosopher, now you get Kant and a Kantian age. So I think you can explain history up to this point, but only up to this point. The social political development goes back. The psychological development of the people goes back to certain decisions in the most abstract minds. Thereafter, you can simply watch and see what happens for good or evil. The most you can ultimately say about an era is its source chose to think or it did not. Now you see here the tremendous power of thought in human life, for good or for evil. And the tremendous power of the individual, of a very, very few individuals, those who exercise the faculty of thought at its most profound, original, and abstract levels. Millions, billions of men may be oblivious to the process, they may be ignorant of philosophy, they may even be contemptuous of abstractions. But knowingly or not, they are shaped ultimately by the abstractions of a small handful of individuals. In this sense, it's far too weak a statement to say that the pen is mightier than the sword. The pen and only a couple of pens create all the swords and the swordsmen and the cause of their battles and the final outcome. Now, you may understandably find this ominous from one point of view, because it would leave the whole world vulnerable to a monster if he unleashes the power of philosophy against them. And that is, of course, what happened in the West in the past two centuries. From another point of view, however, it is not ominous. It can even be regarded as encouraging, because it means that if a good philosopher arises who answers and philosophically destroys the monster, that will overturn the reign of the evil and save the world. And you know that such a philosopher has arisen. I'm speaking in my judgment, I'm sure in most of yours, in our time, and I mean, of course, Ayn Rand. On the basis of the theory of history I've put forward today, therefore, I think it's proper to have hope for the future, ultimately. Ultimately, I do think that objectivism will triumph and shape the world's course, and today's culture will be remembered only as what it is, which I refrain from saying. However, ultimately can be a long time. I don't know how long, nor can philosophy predict that. Perhaps it will be long after all of us are dead. But if we work to spread the right ideas, we each still have a share in bringing about the new world of the future, and we have the rewards that are inherent in that. As Ms. Rand once wrote in another context, I quote her, "Will we see an aesthetic renaissance in our time? I do not know. What I do know is this: anyone who fights for the future lives in it today," unquote. So much for the role of philosophy in history. Thank you. Thank you. Now we have questions.
Regarding the subjectivity of ethics and choice, would you advocate civil disobedience against existing laws if they agree with the objectivist ethic?
Well, that is, has, let us say, at best, a very tangential relationship to the subject today. Would I advocate civil disobedience of laws that disagree with the objectivist ethics as a principle? No, I would not. In some cases, if you want to make a test case and you are prepared to accept the legal consequences of your action, as Rourke in The Fountainhead, who was quite prepared to spend his life in jail because he knew that was the penalty, he understood that they were going to impose it on him, he wanted to make a test case to try to fight the law. But if you mean what is meant today by civil disobedience, mass sit-ins and riots and general hooliganism and mob behavior, absolutely not. A mob does not have any rights that an individual does not, and no form of mob action is valid. And you cannot have a society in which people decide whether they're going to obey the laws or not according to their own viewpoint. You can only say this: if you disagree with the law and you want a test case, that's one thing. Other than that, you have to obey the law and agitate peacefully for its repeal. At the point where agitation is hopeless, that means censorship is already there. You can't argue anymore, in which case then you have to go underground or flee for your life if there's any place to flee. But the precondition of a civilized society is you obey the law and try and change it by peaceful means. That, however, takes us entirely away from this subject, so I'd like to have questions that are more on this topic, if there are any, at the very back, Ron, yeah.
Would you say that the philosophies that have dominated cultures in general have been the ones that at the time had the strongest arguments? And would that support the philosophical?
That's a good question, but I don't think you could say that. Would I say that the philosophies that have always dominated culture have been the ones with the strongest arguments? Well, I couldn't say that, for instance, in any obvious sense, because Aristotle, whatever his defects, had a much stronger argument than Plato, but Plato won out for 1,500 years. By that same token, even Leibniz or whoever, Locke, had a stronger argument than Kant. Anybody has a stronger argument than Kant. So it's not the validity of the argument. What I would say, you could say, is the comprehensiveness of the philosophy, its ability to integrate on a complete, total scale all those issues which are essential to life. Although that's not necessarily the decisive and sole factor, is certainly one crucial factor. That's not the same as valid. But for instance, Plato had something that Aristotle did not have, and that was an ethics. Aristotle, you know, had an ethics, but it was mostly observations of a not very enthusiastic kind about how the noble Athenian should live. It didn't address itself in a passionate, all-encompassing way as here's an ideal that men should live by, the way Plato did. So although Plato's ethics and content are inferior to Aristotle's, in terms of fulfilling a need of man's nature for ethical guidance, Plato came out ahead. And in that sense only, not in the sense of being more valid, he had a stronger philosophy and therefore won. The same is true of Kant, apropos of Locke. Of course, he was much more in ethics. Locke was a sort of deluded Christian. But in addition, Kant included in one system every issue of any importance that anyone before him ever thought of, and integrated it in one total, whereas the typical British empiricist method of dealing with questions was not to cover them if they didn't know what to say. So Kant had a formidable system. So I think you get my point. I'm sure there are many other factors, but it's not validity that determines influence. So it depends what you mean by strength. And the young lady way at the back, yes.
Can you explain a little further how ideas are disseminated through institutions? Is it all today through the colleges?
How ideas are disseminated through institutions. Is it all through the colleges? No, it is not all. Only 98%. Or to put it another way, it is primarily through the colleges, because the colleges are the ones that turn out all other disseminators. The colleges turn out, directly or indirectly, the grade school teachers and the politicians and the journalists and the ministers and the movie makers and etc. And they are the ones who then disseminate on a more popular level within the sphere of their particular audience and influence. Consequently, at the root of it all is the abstract ideas taught in the colleges. But that doesn't mean that everybody had to go to college or be influenced directly by a professor. Although the only way to change it is to change the colleges. You could spend your life trying to change politicians, it would be hopeless, because a good politician would be corroded as soon as he got into power or would never run. So you can't work on a political level. At the very back, I can just see fingers. Yes.
Would you say that it's basically the epistemology
What I say that it's basically the epistemology of an originator that gives it its strength. Basically, but not entirely, because in the case of Aristotle, his epistemology, relatively speaking, was in good shape, but his ethics was the weak link in the chain. And people, after all, have to live by a philosophy. So most people get philosophy directly through ethics, rather than through epistemology. Now, of course, that in itself depends upon epistemology, so ultimately epistemology is the decisive element. But epistemology pure, however good it is, without the ethics would not do anything on a cultural level until someone came up with the ethics. And you can see this very easily by this simple fact. If Ayn Rand had written Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology only, even assuming 12 volumes, so there was no concept or gimmick or angle that anybody could dream of that she didn't cover, you would not be here today. One or two people would read it and tell their grandchildren, and centuries later, someone would come up with an ethics. And then it would go into fiction or whatever, and then people would hear about it. So you see, ethics is really essential. People live by value judgments and then discover that it depends on epistemology. Epistemology by itself would not do it. I don't know why I'm discriminating against the back. Yes, I'm in the front. Yes.
I don't understand how, unless I misunderstand what you're saying, how it is that the process of evasion, if you treat evasion as choice to not think, can lead one to, in this case, Immanuel Kant, to a highly abstract system of ideas. How can evasion lead to a highly abstract system of ideas? I would think that would be possible even in direction.
Well, you're equivocating on thinking. How can evasion lead to a system of ideas? Now, I did say that I do not make his psychology the cause of his philosophy. So I'm not saying because he was an evader, he came up with those ideas. Certainly not. But my whole point is that it is what he did with his mind by choice that led him to his ideas. Now, he did evade, in my judgment, because he did things beyond what can be permitted honestly. So you want to ask amounts to this question. How can a person be very abstract and simultaneously evade? I don't see that there's any problem, because very abstract does not mean relating to reality. Very abstract means he is concerned with questions on this order. What is the relation between the way we form concepts and the motivation we should have when we go to work? I mean, that's what I would call an abstract connection. Or what is the connection between the way we feel with our fingers when we touch something and whether roads should or shouldn't be privately owned? Now, those questions are simply beyond most people. An abstract philosopher is at home with exact of the type I'm talking about. Not today's, you know, because today's philosophers are lower, you know, even than non-philosophers on that point. But an abstract philosopher thinks on those questions, and that's exactly what Kant did. Now, there's nothing to say you have to be honest in doing that. You can have a completely corrupt theories. You can make it up out of whole cloth. You can be governed by subconscious motives, whatever you want. There's no connection between the two. If you try to do it honestly, then, of course, it's impossible. You can't combine it. But abstraction and honesty are two separate things. Ellsworth Toohey was extremely abstract. Now, you might say he had the advantage of Ms. Rand writing his speeches. But still, he was very abstract, but he was certainly dishonest. Also, there is such a thing as thinking within the square, as cutting off certain things and then thinking within that narrowly defined context. You're just not going to, for instance, you're not going to think about the fact that producers are necessary. You just obliterate that. When you hear the word producer or production, you just push that aside as something you think is bad, evil, disgusting, frightening, who knows, hateful, whatever. And then you simply think, well, how should man live? The goods are here. What follows from that? We should do this. You can be very abstract. You just have blocked off one whole area. That is very common, and there is a sense in which all bad philosophers do this. Kant's system has an inner logic, a very brilliant inner logic, like a diabolical maze. So in that sense, he doesn't just evade and, you know, say this and then that, just whatever he feels like. He evades certain essentials and then constructs his connections outside of them. Yes? How do you go about changing the colleges? I don't know. I haven't done very successfully. The colleges are very entrenched, and the problem is that when they get that influential, they end freedom for the population, and you have a situation like now where all the established people have tenure and the faculties are shrinking and you couldn't get in for love or money. So it's very hard to change them from within. They're not dependent on money because they get essentially government support, even the private ones. So you have very few levers of access to the colleges. The long-range way is simply keep agitating for ideas in forums outside colleges, in books, in lectures, in whatever. And little by little, you have to hope that a young generation will come up who will hear this, will be able to get a foothold in the colleges, you know, and penetrate through their armor. It is a very slow, a very disheartening process. And one of the most disheartening things is that the better young people get a look at what they have to go through to get a PhD in philosophy and quit. They just won't go through it, which is a form of self-preservation. So you have tremendous obstacles. Now, if you want something more practical than a long-range thing, I'll tell you the following, which I would like kept in confidence. But since I mentioned this in Los Angeles, I may as well, I won't discriminate against New York. We are in process. Now, this is a very tentative, I have to qualify this to death. This is very tentative and very hypothetical. It is not definite. I don't know that it will materialize. If you know the epistemological distinctions, I would say this is possible but not probable. However, with all that being said, we are in process of exploring the possibility of founding something that we are calling the Ayn Rand Institute and subtitled the Center for the Advancement of Objectivism, one of whose primary mandates would be to do everything possible to get objectivism a hearing on college campuses, whether through dissemination of books, lectures, clubs, whatever. If this gets off the ground, there will be a full-time staff doing whatever can be done on this topic. But how much can be done, I still remain questionable about. I don't know whether you can speed up history. I really don't know. Aristotle had to wait how many centuries? And it may very well be that way again. But all that I would know to do is try to penetrate the colleges with ideas and hope that something good would result. But we've had very bad experiences with the colleges. You undoubtedly know the story of what happened when Harry Binswanger gave a course on objectivism at Berkeley and the virulent antagonism he generated from the philosophy department, who went so far as to circulate a page of excerpts from the Ominous Parallels, along with the statement that this self-evidently is unqualified, anyone who would write this, to be heard on the campus at Berkeley. Now, I mean, this is the advocates of academic freedom and free speech, you know. So you can just from that alone, and I could multiply the stories, but if I do, I would sound paranoid, of the hostility of the colleges, because they know that this is the end of their reign, and therefore it's a very difficult thing. There's no happy answer that I can think of to your question. Yes?
Could you review what you did in the study of TJI about the interaction of psychology and philosophy in the individual person?
No. In the question period, you mean?
Well, you talked about it. I don't know when it was, but in San Diego, you talked about the interaction of the person's psychology and the philosophy, the individual's philosophy.
The only thing.
One really doesn't start before the other, they start talking.
I don't recall mentioning that, and that seems to me more a question for a psychologist to answer, because it's on childhood development. The only thing I would say is this. You have to be very careful of making, the question was the interaction of psychology and philosophy in a developing child. You have to be very careful when you indicate that there is a distinction. In most cases, there is not a distinction. The person holds certain ideas implicitly, and they are even at a young age, the equivalent of his philosophy at that stage. And those ideas program him, affect his emotions, his subconscious connections, and so on. And if you want to call that his psychology, that's his psychology. So if it's only the distinction between thought and emotion, then there's nothing, there is no conflict. Conflict between psychology and philosophy, I believe, is a relatively exalted state of affairs. In other words, I think it happens to a comparatively few people. The normal case where a person has a conflict between his philosophy and his psychology, I'll take the people that I know in objectivism, some of whom have that situation, is they were brought up, let us say, with a religious philosophy, which they accepted, or with, I don't know, whatever type of mind-body dichotomy, even if not explicitly religious. They then come across Ayn Rand's books, and they're impressed, and intellectually they accept those ideas. But, you know, the wrong ideas are still there and were integrated across many, many years of development to so many concretes and so many psychological interconnections to the rest of their psychology that they just don't go away just because you see, you say, I see they're wrong. The uprooting of these ideas is a tremendously lengthy and complex process, and I basically think you need a psychotherapist for that. I don't know anybody that can do that on their own if they have any kind of significant conflict. Now, that type of case, you could say, is a conflict temporarily. Temporarily, because if the person doesn't resolve it, I don't think you can go to old age with that. At a certain point, you know, you end up saying, well, look, I can't change my psychology, and I have to live, and that's it. Goodbye to the philosophy. You can only repress so long. It's just a temporary thing. So some people, and already you have to be in a relatively small minority to have that conflict, because most people just accept what they're taught. They have no challenge against what they've been brought up with, so they don't have that kind of, they may have many other conflicts and inconsistencies and guilts and fears, but there's nothing that you could describe as this is what they think and versus this is what they feel. They don't think, they don't have ideas, so it's already a small minority who would say, I officially hold ideas at variance with the culture. And then it's a group within that minority that is not able fully to digest the new ideas and therefore has this conflict. But I don't think on a historical scale that has any significance. Is that what you wanted? Okay. Are you trying to get me off of here, George? Two more. Okay. Somebody new. Yes. Yes. No, only one.
One is, why do you want to celebrate World History of Facebook?
Okay. All right.
What influence, if any, have the Freemasons had on the philosophical current?
Well, I'll have to reject a second. I don't know anything about Freemasonry, and my answer would be no influence, because the level on which I'm talking, you have to have an abstract technical philosophy to have influence. On the question of why do I want to accelerate the course of history, because I'd like to live a long life. I'd like not to be bombed in a war. I'd like not to live under a dictatorship. I'd like to be able to go to a doctor and have a reasonable expectation that I would be given the necessary treatment if I could afford it. I'd like to live. If a person could live entirely in his soul, without a reference to the trends of society, and if there was no worry about having to live under a dictatorship and everything that that would involve, I'd say, to hell with history. But unfortunately, you live in this world surrounded by people, and if they hold hostile ideas, and those ideas dominate the governmental institutions, they will end up taking a gun and using it to force their wishes on you, and that will end up in general slaughter, including you and me. And it's for that very practical reason only that I'm interested in changing the trend. Ayn Rand used to say that she was interested in politics only to reach the day when she didn't have to care about it anymore. One last question, and that is from whom? Does somebody have a summarizing? Oh, I got a question. Oh, yeah, I lost it. Yes, okay.
Any word on Atlas Shrugged Project?
There is no word worth mentioning. There is still negotiations going on. Heraclitus is still right. You cannot step into the same negotiation twice. Nothing has been signed. It is barely possible that a movie will be made, a theatrical movie. As and when and if something develops, which conceivably might in a month or never, or sometime between, it'll be announced in the objectivist form. There's really nothing of significance. But that, can I take 1 minute? I wanted to ask a favor in conclusion. I've chosen the topic of my next Ford Hall speech, and I'd just like it to get a chance, since you're all active New Yorkers or East Coast people, if you could help me with research in the following way. My topic is medicine, the death of a profession. And my theme is the negative effects of government funding on the morale of doctors and the actual quality of medicine that's being practiced today. I have interviewed doctors fairly extensively out west, but I'm interested in contacting medical people, either doctors, nurses, hospital administrators, etc., who have real-life examples of what Medicare, Medicaid, and all the alphabet associated with them. And by the alphabet associated with them, I mean, if you don't know what this means, it doesn't make any difference because I only want the people who know what this means. DRGs, HMOs, PROs, that whole crew. If you know anything about how those things are actually working in a medical situation, I would most appreciate a note or literature or whatever you have, and you can reach me at Box 177, Murray Hill Station, New York 10016. Thank you very much.